So we get to talk about Judah today in our study of characters through the Old Testament. And so, for your cultural enrichment, this is a picture done by Aert de Gelder. He was a Dutch artist back in the late 1600s to early 1700s. He was one of the last students of Rembrandt. He tutored under Rembrandt himself, and he painted in the style of Rembrandt. And he's probably one of his best students that he had. But that's a new artist for you to see. As far as Judah, as we're going to talk about him, the early years for Judah, we know that he was the fourthborn son of Leah. So who was the firstborn son? Begins with an R. Reuben. And then who came next? Begins with an S. Simeon. And after him was Levi. And then we get to Judah. And Judah's name means praise the Lord, or praise of the Lord. The first words that are written about Judah occur when Joseph is in the pit. Now, Reuben's not here at the time, but Judah's going to say to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. For he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Now, Jewish tradition tells us that Judah was the big brother in terms of size and just physical appearance. Now, whether he was or not, I don't know. But what we can tell from this is just because he was a fourthborn doesn't mean his voice wasn't listened to by his other brothers. Now, again, Reuben wasn't here when this happened, and Judah doesn't want to kill his brother, but he figures, let's just ship him off to the Ishmaelites. If something happens to him, it happens to him. It's his own fault. There's also no regard for his dad or what his dad's going to think. He knows that Joseph's a favorite son, but that's of little consequence to Judah at this time. The other thing to note, too, that we learned from Josh last week, and we'll see in Judah also, and actually in Simeon as well, or Reuben as well, right after this, we'll read about Reuben coming to the pit and Joseph's not there. And the first words out of Reuben's mouth aren't, what happened to Joseph? What about him? No, Reuben is more concerned about what happens to me. What's everyone going to say about me now that Joseph is gone? Jacob, as Josh taught us last week, when Jacob and the whole incident at Shechem occurred, his sons, remember Simeon and Levi, go in and wipe out all those men. Jacob's not concerned about the families of the lost over there. No, he's concerned about, what's everybody going to say about me? What have you done to me? We're going to see that same attitude play itself out in Judah a little bit later. The thing for us to learn from that is that men, as we set examples for our children, I'm sure Jacob didn't take time to train his children, hey, this is something I want you to do. No, they just pick it up and they mimic it. So we open chapter 38, and the thing about chapter 38, it's going to occur over a period of roughly 20 years, maybe just a little bit longer than 20 years. And it's this little brief thing. Now, Joseph is gone. He's been taken away in the caravan by the Ishmaelites. And so now here's this little interlude, and we'll read. It came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there was a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Now then in our story, if y'all can see that very well, there's Hebron right there, so things kind of start there. Well, the area we're talking about is about 15 miles northwest of there, so this town called Adulla. 15 miles northwest of there, it's also a descent for him as well. He's up about 3,000 feet, so he's actually descending into this area. Have a picture of what's happening to Judah. He's descending into this mess that he's getting ready to get into. This verse also goes on to say that Judah saw there was a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. That's her father's name. And he took her and went into her. Now, usually the word took that it uses there isn't a big deal associated with marriage. However, in Genesis, when you put the idea of he saw her and he took her, Those two words are used together in a few other places in Genesis. The first time we see it is with Eve. She saw the apple was good and she took it. The next time we read about that occurs in Genesis 6, where it talks about the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took them and they made wives with them, made wives out of them. The next instance is going to occur in Genesis 12, where the servants of Pharaoh saw that Sarah was beautiful, and they took her to live in the Pharaoh's household. And finally, in Genesis 34, we'll read about, the guy from Shechem that took Dinah. Took Dinah, saw that Dinah was beautiful, took her, and we know what happened in that case as well. So this idea that he took her to be his wife isn't necessarily associated with this idea that he loved her, that there was some emotional attachment. It was more associated with lust. He saw that she was beautiful and he took her. We also get that indication too because her name is never mentioned. It's the daughter of a guy named Shua. That's as much as we know. So this idea that there was some type of emotional attachment, perhaps not, probably not. So she conceived and bore a son and named him Ur, Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. And she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Chibiz that she bore him. So we see this birth order, boom, 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 three sons just right off the bat. Continuing on. Now Judah took a wife for Ur. So now time has passed. Ur's been born. Ur's the firstborn. And now time has passed. And he took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. The kind of interesting thing about Ur, and kind of a sidelight, two letters, and I think his name means guard or something like that in Hebrew, but if you take those two letters in Hebrew and flip them, it becomes the word evil. Just ha-ha from God, I guess. I don't know. Let's see. And the other thing to point out in that previous verse as well, Tamar herself wasn't involved in the evil that was associated with Ur. Whatever Ur did, God punished him. Tamar is, if you will, a guiltless wife of this evil man. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so he went into his brother's wife. He wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. This idea that go into your brother's wife and perform your duty, it's actually a term that was used, not associated with the Levitical law, but it's spelled E-L-E-I-V-R-A-T-E. Liberate, I believe, is a word. But it's an idea that within societies of that time, that the brother of the dead brother would go in and make sure that his name carried on. So it wasn't just a tradition or something taught by Israelites only. It was done by society as a whole to ensure that the brother's name would go on. And it was the responsibility of the father-in-law to ensure that his name would go on. And the clinical name for what his brother had done, Onan, was called coitus interruptus, by just not fulfilling what he was supposed to do. And again, what he did was evil in the sight of the Lord to the point that God took his life. And again, Tamar was guiltless in this. She had nothing to do with it. She was doing what she was supposed to be doing as now the widow of Ur. And still, this happened. In Genesis 38:11, we read, "Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, 'Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up.' For he thought, 'I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers.' So Tamar went and lived in her father's house." So now we see Tamar removed. Judah's a little bit concerned about what's going to happen to the third brother. first two sons have been killed by the Lord because of their disobedience. And now the third son, he's not ready to give him up to this woman. So he says, go live with her. He's still a young guy, which sounds somewhat reasonable. Go live with your dad, and I'll let you know when he's ready. Well, didn't quite end up like that. In verse 12 we read, now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah. I'm going to stop right there real quick. Right now, Judah has lost Ur, and he's lost Onan. And nowhere do we read about his mourning for his son's death. His firstborn especially, you'd think there'd be something written about that, but there's no mourning associated with that. There's no mourning associated with Onan. Now, we realize both of those guys were disobedient. But now we read about Judah's wife. Again, we don't know her name, but she died. And when the time of mourning was ended, it's not the fact that his mourning was over or that he even mourned, but the appropriate time for him to mourn had ended. So, again, we see this idea of Judah just not really being attached to his family in some type of emotional way. He's just going through the motions of everything. So Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah. He and his friend Hira the Adullamite, it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to share his sheep. And this whole sheep shearing festival, as they would refer to it, was a time of party, wine drinking and everything else, carousing, whatever else you can imagine. It wasn't the greatest of times, but it was a celebration, and so let the wine start flowing. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat at the gateway of Enmon, which is the road to Timnah, which she saw, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. So again, this idea that Judah is not fulfilling his obligation as the father-in-law to ensure the name of Ur and his descendants would continue on. She's aware of this. It's been past time. She's waited faithfully. She's done everything she's supposed to do. Now it's time for her to take action, and this is what we're going to start seeing. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered up her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? At this point, it's just a business agreement. How much is this going to cost? Genesis 38:17 says, he said, therefore, I will send you a goat from the flock. She said, moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it? He said, what pledge shall I give you? She said, your seal and your cord and your staff that's in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments and basically went back to her father's house. But as we read here, what will you pledge? Well, he gave her his seal, his cord, and his staff. Pretty much he opened up the wallet and gave her the credit card. Here you go. Now, pretty much the guy had on his mind just one thing, probably influenced with some wine. Not the best judgment of times, but he had his mission he was going to accomplish, and that was it. Now, she, on the other hand, once everything's done, she's going to go back to where she was and wait. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, again, he's getting his friend to do the dirty work now. He went out, he found the girl, he slept with her, but now the payoff, he's going to get his buddy to take care of that. He can't be seen paying off the prostitute. Nope, he's going to get his buddy. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who is here by the road at Enaim? But they said, there's been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there's been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. Well, yeah, his friend tried to find her with the goat. And the other idea, too, is let her keep them. I don't want to be a laughingstock. I don't want my name tarnished. I can't find her. I don't know what happened to her. Maybe she's dead somewhere. But I can't be associated with this. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law, Tamar, has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. This idea that Judah was informed, as calculating as Tamar was, I don't think this got out without Tamar knowing it. I know that from at least our experience with the kids, when Kathy was 3 months pregnant, she showed a little bit, but not significantly. And if she wore something loose, it wasn't that noticeable. So I think Tamar orchestrated getting this information out to Judah to find out, to get his reaction. The other reaction that we see from Judah is bring her out and let her be burned. Typically the punishment for adultery, because it was adultery, she was supposed to be betrothed to Shelah. That was supposed to be her husband, and now she's pregnant, and Shelah wasn't the husband. So now it's adultery, and typically it's supposed to be you're supposed to be stoned to death because of something like this. But no, he wants her to be burned. And we read in Levitical law, if you are the daughter of a high priest and you committed adultery, you should be burned. That's what the Levitical law said. Well, this is Judah just upping the measure, saying, my family was violated by this woman. I demand not just punishment, but severe punishment. Our name will be vindicated. And that's Judah. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff these are. Judah recognized them and said, She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son, Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. So now everything is exposed. It's him who was the father of her child. It was he that did not keep his promise to provide a husband for her. And this is Judah's confession, that she is much more righteous than I. And this is a big point for Judah, because he's admitting that he was wrong. And no man likes to do that. And yet Judah is doing this. Now it says that he was wrong for not giving her to his son, providing that. But it also says later, and he did not have relations with her again. The idea of incest between the father and the daughter-in-law was wrong. Even at that time, it was wrong and punishable. And so he realized that and didn't do it again. So that part he did. But the big part to him was not keeping his promise. That was the big sin in his life that he acknowledged. It came about at that time she was giving birth, that behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach have you made for yourself? So he was named Perez, meaning breach. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. And this is pretty much where our story is going to stop right now. With these three sons. You've got Shelah that's out there, and now Perez and Zerah. And we know that Perez is going to be the son of promise through which our Messiah would come. But the thing to note, too, is with these three, and how many years were... Because the guys are getting ready to move to Egypt, right? We know that from Josh, he'll talk to us next week. Everyone's getting ready to move to Egypt. How long are we going to stay in Egypt? How many? 420 years. Excuse me. And then the book of Numbers is going to be written just a little bit after that, right? That's because Moses is going to take care of doing all that stuff. And so that's going to be done then. So somewhere a little over 400 years later, Numbers is going to take place. And in there, they're going to talk about the tribe of Judah. And they're going to ask for a number to be calculated of the men over the age of 20 who are capable of fighting. And any idea how many men that is? They're going to be counted up. No idea. Give me a number. That's okay. There are going to be about 74,600 men that are able to fight from the tribe of Judah. That's the largest tribe in terms of number. And this is a humble beginning that it's going to come from this type of incident. It's God's grace. Remember, God had told Abraham that I'd make your descendants numerous. Well, that was a good start, as we see God's blessing them in spite of all the sin that had occurred around them. Because it would have been so easy for God to... You and I know if we were God, we would have just said, no, I'm not dealing with this, and just wipe them off. But he didn't. Excuse me. But why did God include this chapter in Genesis? I mean, we've been talking about Joseph. Why did we have to do this? Well, in one case, it's going to be to contrast the life of Joseph and the life of Judah. In this case, moral character versus immoral character. Josh talked to us last week about the choices that Joseph had to make with regard to Potiphar's wife. And probably 99 out of, probably today, 100 men out of 100 men would have taken Potiphar's wife's offer. But Joseph didn't. Judah, on the other hand, he didn't have that difficult decision to make. He just knew what he was supposed to do, and yet he chose not to do it. And we see this comparison and contrast throughout Genesis. It starts out with Cain and Abel, right? There's Cain and Abel that they talk about. There's Jacob and Esau that they talk about. Lot and Abraham they talk about. All those things, this is just another tool used in the narrative to compare and contrast these two. And I thought this was kind of interesting. I don't know that... I think it's interesting. I wanted to share this with you. And this was to show why God led the people to Egypt. In other words, why would God's chosen people in the promised land, and they were there, famine occurred, yeah, I understand, but he had everyone go to Egypt. And why did they go to Egypt? Why would God want them to do that? Well, for one reason, the Canaanites were a very immoral and idolatrous people, right? We've known that from Josh teaching us, as well as Pastor Tim teaching us. Canaanites were not moral people whatsoever and very idolatrous. We also have seen that Abraham's descendants intermarry with the Canaanites, usually with disastrous results. Now, with that in mind, too, remember Abraham and Isaac had always told their sons, get a woman. Do not get a woman from the Canaanites. Go back home and find a woman from there. Isaac had his wife brought to him by Abraham's servant. When Jacob was old enough, Rebekah and Isaac told him, go back to Laban, find a wife from among my relatives for you that's suitable. Do not marry the Canaanite. We already know what happened with Esau when he married the Canaanite and how much displeasure and disharmony that brought to Isaac and Rebekah, because the Bible tells us that. So this whole idea that they were supposed to marry properly in Judah, I'm going to go back real quick. Judah, I think, probably knew Jacob's feeling about going back and getting a wife from among their relatives back east, or back west, I should say. But he chose not to do that. Again, he saw her and he took her to be his wife. The Egyptians, as we read in a little bit later in Genesis, are going to detest the Hebrews, and there was very little intermarriage going on with that group. So once they moved to Egypt, it was just them in Egypt. And all the intermarrying that was going to occur was going to be amongst themselves. And God's people would come from that. Now, can I prove that without beyond a reasonable doubt? Probably not. But I thought it was a neat observation that was put there. And God will tell us when we get to heaven why he did that. The story of Judah and Tamar also demonstrates the grace of God. We see the changes in Judah's life. His early attitude towards his brother and father were completely disrespectful. He hated his brother. He had no regard for Jacob and for what his feelings for Joseph himself. It was just all about what he wanted. But then we see with his confession of sin with Tamar, we see a changing in him. It wasn't night and day, perhaps, but it certainly was admitting that he was wrong and she was less wrong than I am. Now, next week, as Josh will teach us, we'll see Judah's intercession on behalf of Benjamin. And it's not just Benjamin that he's pleading with. He's pleading with Joseph on behalf of Benjamin to not put him in prison. And at that point, he has concern not just for Benjamin, but also for his father, because he sees what the imprisonment of Benjamin will do to his father. And it bothers him. It upsets him to the point where he says, take me. Don't let this happen to Benjamin, to my father. So now he's displaying more concern for his family and what he should be doing and making intercession for them. So we see this whole change in Judah's life. Though his actual words, Josh will talk about that next week, though his words through chapter 38 are not necessarily recorded in all that he said, we can see by his actions how he is affected by this. Romans 5:20 and 21 tells us, the law came in so that transgression would decrease, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more, so that sin reigned in death, and even so grace would reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. I know I'm kind of ripping this out of context when I said, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. But in the story of Tamar and Judah, we do see this abundance of sin. But the result of all that sin, God's grace was there. And it's God's grace is going to be manifest as we read through Matthew, where it talks about the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And Perez was the father of Hezron. And Hezron, the father of Ram. And it goes on to talk about Christ coming through there. Now, Tamar is mentioned here. Who are the other three women that are mentioned in the lineage of Christ? Rahab. And Rahab was a Gentile prostitute. Who else?
Bathsheba.
She was an adulteress with David. And who's the last one?
Ruth,
a Gentile. Not exactly an all-star lineup. And yet God used all these people to accomplish his purpose, which to me is an encouragement, because I certainly don't see myself as an all-star. But I'm thankful that God uses us to accomplish his purposes. So as far as our practical applications for this, don't be too quick to point fingers at someone's sin. Jesus verbalized this when he said, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, brother, let me take the speck out that is in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will be able to see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. Remember how Judah wanted to just wipe out Tamar immediately? Once he found out that she was pregnant, take her out, burn her. Don't be too quick. Keep your promises. In this case, it's keeping our promises to our friends, to our family, to our coworkers. You name it, we should keep our promises. And finally, fulfill your family obligations. Paul wrote to Timothy telling him, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Judah learned this firsthand, that he had not fulfilled his family's obligation. And that bothered him to the point, that bothered him to such a degree that he confessed that he had done wrong. And it just doesn't stop there. I'm sure each of us men can think of our own faults and our own shortcomings associated with our families. And for you guys, Dad tried, but I know that I've got mine, and y'all, I'm sure, can document them easily. Yeah, you survive, but still. We keep on going. Now, just kind of in closing, I know we're a little bit early, and that's okay. June and Tamar is not the prettiest story we're going to read in the Bible. It doesn't have the romantic ending or any of that kind of stuff. It certainly wasn't a romance or anything like that. But it does show God's grace and mercy. And I think grace and mercy shown to them. And I think when we get to heaven too, we only get a glimpse of what that grace and mercy is. When we get to heaven, we'll see the full scope of God's grace and mercy. And we'll fall on our knees and just worship and thank God for what he's done for us. Y'all have any questions or anything? I've kind of blown through this. I hope y'all have enjoyed it, because I enjoyed going through this. This was kind of fun. Thank y'all. Oh.
What's the time frame? This is right after we sold Joseph,
right? Yeah. This occurs about a 20 to maybe 21 year period of time, the story encapsulates. So everything, and then we go back to Joseph. So again, this is, as we read Genesis, it's not supposed to be the story of Joseph. It's supposed to be the story of Jacob's sons. And so it primarily focuses on Joseph, but we do get a glimpse of this as well in there. Okay. Thank you. And y'all are dismissed.